Hi guys, thanks very much for coming along tonight. It's great to be in Montana. I grew up reading Field and Stream magazines and Sports Afield and things like that, and I always wanted to hunt elk in Montana and mule deer and, you know, go up mountains and down rivers and that sort of thing. So it's a real thrill to be here. You live in a beautiful state. I come from a very nice country, but this is a stunning place here. Can everybody hear me up the back okay? Can everybody understand my accent? If you can't, let me know. I didn't know I had one till I came here. But I've been informed many times that I do. So look, it's great to be here. It's great to be amongst patriots because we're coming to a very critical time in your country's future, a critical time that's going to impact every free country in the world. And I want to start this very simple question I always get asked. Why I should care about the internal politics of your country. And I say there are two reasons. The first is straight out gratitude because my country was only saved in World War II, because of the huge sacrifice of your fathers and grandfathers and uncles in the battles of Guadalcanal and Midway and the Coral Sea. And there's a lot of gratitude in my country for that. The second reason is related, but a little bit more selfish. Ronald Reagan had it right. This is the last best hope for mankind. If freedom fails in the United States of America, it will fail everywhere. If you lose your world leadership and your military superiority and your moral compass, the bad guys of this world, and I'm talking about Russia and China and Iran and Cuba and Nicaragua and Venezuela and North Korea and all their allies, will basically carve up this planet amongst themselves. Now I get emails all the time from Americans and they'll say, look, if things go bad here, if Obama gets back in, can I come and live in New Zealand? And I say, come down, you'll enjoy it, have a great holiday. But this is no refuge. This is the front line now. There is nowhere to run. 1,500 miles to the north of my country lie the beautiful Fijian Islands. Great tourist destination, but they now have a Marxist-led government. China is training the Fijian military and is building big hydroelectric dams on the islands. Fiji is now a Chinese client state. And that is happening right throughout the South Pacific. A few months ago, the Australian Minister of Defence was up in China for talks. And a top Chinese official publicly embarrassed him. He said, now is the time for Australia to choose. Do you stay under American protection or do you come under Chinese protection? And that kind of veiled threat would not have happened under Reagan or Bush or even under Clinton. But it is happening now because the bad guys of the world see the leadership that is coming out of your White House and it's making them very, very confident. And all around this planet, your allies from Israel to Canada to Japan to Australia are all freaking out because they see that your president seems to love the bad guys more than he loves them. And that's causing a lot of fear, a lot of uncertainty, and a lot of instability. It's altering the balance of power on this planet. And if it carries on, there's only one place it's going to lead. And that is war and or slavery. Your president cries peace, but he's leading you towards war, a war that you may not win. So, I want to start out talking about what I call the central secret of communism. You all know that communism doesn't exist anymore and it's all, you know, we don't have to worry about it, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. This big secret of communism, it's very seldom discussed, is not atom bomb spies or Occupy rock throwers. It is the ability of a tiny Marxist-Leninist party to get their policies implemented as the law of the land in their country. So how could that be? How could a small group of communists, maybe a few hundred strong, or a few thousand, how could they possibly influence public policy in a country of 10 million or 100 million voters? How is that conceivable in this modern age? Well, I want to give some examples of how it's done, and I'll start with one from my own country, New Zealand. Back in 1984, we elected a socialist Labour government. And the first thing they did was to enact legislation banning nuclear warships from our harbours. And as you people were the only people sending nuclear warships to our harbours, that overnight destroyed the Australia-New Zealand-United States military alliance. ANZUS killed it stone cold dead. And it still hasn't been revived to this day. So how could a pro-Western, pro-American country like New Zealand, who'd been saved by you guys only a few decades before, how come at the height of the Cold War we could turn our backs on the Western alliance? Well, this is how it was done. A few years after that, I had the privilege over several months of interviewing a New Zealander who had infiltrated our Communist Party for our security intelligence services. He was basically a government spy inside the New Zealand Communist Party. And he worked his way up right through the ranks, very clever guy. And in 1983, he was given the greatest honour any communist could enjoy. He was sent to Moscow to train at Lenin's Institute for Higher Learning in Leningradsky Prospect. And this was not a small place. This was 3,500 students at any one time, many of them on seven-year courses, many of them with one-to-one tutelage. This was the training academy of the future world communist leadership. And there were people there from Sri Lanka and the Philippines and Taiwan and Spain and South Africa and Egypt and Kenya and Luxembourg and Canada. Virtually every country of the free world was represented except for one. And that was you guys, the United States, the main enemy. So why were no Americans training at Lenin's Institute? Because at some point, your government had told the Soviets that were any Americans ever caught training there, there would be war. And the Soviets respected that. But what they would do, they would train Canadians or Mexicans or New Zealanders in the doctrines they wanted promoted, and those people would go and train the American communists. So my friend sat down in a room with the other three members of his delegation, people from the KGB and tutors from the Institute. And they had a plan. It was a very important plan. Because this was the time of the massive anti-nuclear marches through Europe. Hundreds of thousands of people marching through European capitals protesting against NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which you guys are the linchpin of, against the nuclear umbrella over Europe, against nuclear power, hundreds of thousands of people. And there was a real fear in some quarters that NATO would break up if this carried on. And of course, the Soviet Union was funding all of these peace marches and the communist parties who were organizing them, because they wanted NATO to break up, because that would give them dominance of Europe. And then, as today, and this is very important, as today, your military and your military alliances are Moscow's number one target. Absolutely number one. Because nothing else stands between them and what they want, which is world domination. So the Soviets had a plan. They're thinking, well, okay, we've got this European thing going on. If we push this, we can break up NATO. But how about being clever? What about if we can break away another country outside of Europe from the Western alliance? Think of the psychological and propaganda impact of that. If we can do that, that's going to help the breakup of NATO. So they picked on New Zealand. Remember, the Soviets are chess players. Very subtle people. They picked on New Zealand because we're small, progressive, socially liberal, and the communists were very strong in our Labour Party. They'd infiltrated the Labour Party. They controlled our labour unions and they controlled our peace movement. So the idea was this. We want New Zealand to leave ANZUS, but we can't sell this as an anti-American thing because New Zealanders love America. They're grateful to America. So how are we going to do it? They thought, well, this is going to have to be a patriotic New Zealand thing. This is going to have to be Kiwis standing up for peace. Kiwis standing against the nuclear arms race. New Zealanders striking an independent foreign policy course. All patriotic, pro-New Zealand, pro-Kiwi stuff. So they worked out all the slogans. They brought in the psychologists. They had it all worked out, just like they do with focus groups here in America. They worked out all the slogans they'd have to use. And this little delegation went back to New Zealand, had secret meetings with the Labour Party, secret meetings with the unions and the peace movement, and they mounted a campaign, and in a few short months, that legislation was in front of the New Zealand Parliament, it was signed off, and our alliance with your country was killed stone cold dead. Just like that. And I'll tell you, a lot of Americans, a lot of Kiwis come to Montana for hunting and skiing and fishing. And if you ask any of them about our anti-nuclear stand of 1984, which is still in existence, they'll puff out their chest with pride. And they'll say, yeah, we did it. We stood up for peace. We stood against the nuclear arms race. And they'll be so proud. And hardly one of them in 4 million would have any idea that those policies were designed by the KGB at Lenin's Institute for Higher Learning in Moscow. Totally duped. But could that happen in America, the home of the brave, the land of the free? Could that happen here? Well, I want to give a couple of examples. And I'll start with a small symbolic one first, out of California. Where else? Okay. Every year in California, they get a day's paid holiday to celebrate the life of the great labor union leader, Cesar Chavez. A day off work. Cesar Chavez, the man who trained under Saul Alinsky in Chicago, the Marxist agitator, worked with communists and socialists his entire life, and marched under the famous slogan, Si se puede, si se puede, yes we can. Some of you might have heard that one. And Obama acknowledges that's exactly where it came from. But the woman who got that implemented and has now gone to 11 states is a woman called Evelina Alarcón of the Cesar Chavez holiday campaign. And she got a whole bunch of left-wing movie stars, all her friends in the California labor unions, and her network of supporters in the California state legislature, and she got it pushed through. And now she's got it in 11 states, and she wants to take it nationwide. And her website proudly lists the endorsement for that campaign of President Obama himself. And President Obama was down in California just a week ago, making Cesar Chavez's home into a national monument. But I'm sure Mr. Obama wouldn't have known, and I'm sure most Californians would have no idea, but Evelina Alarcón is the leader of the Southern California Communist Party USA. But she has changed legislation in 11 states, a hardcore communist, and got your president to support her. So what about a bigger example, a real meaty, grunty example that is going to affect every single American? Stands to socialise between 1/6 and 1/4 of your economy. Can anybody guess what that might be? Obamacare. Now I acknowledge that Obamacare is not yet fully socialised healthcare, not yet single payer, but we know where it's going to head if it's allowed to stand, and it cannot be allowed to stand. Now the father of the single payer socialised healthcare movement in this country is a man called Quentin Young, a retired Chicago physician. He's pushing 90, but he's been working on this since the 1950s, setting up doctors' groups, working with state legislatures, alliances all over the country, working with congressmen like John Conyers. He's been pushing this relentlessly for 50 years. But it was only in 2009, under President Obama, with the Affordable Health Care Act, that they actually started to make progress. And it's no surprise the progress came under President Obama, because for many years in Chicago, Quentin Young was Barack Obama's personal physician. He openly claims credit for indoctrinating Obama into the ideas of socialized healthcare. But more than that, Quentin Young was a 40-year veteran of the Communist Party USA until he left that organization to set up a new Marxist group called Democratic Socialists of America. Now, if you think that sounds a bit wimpy and democratic and it's only socialist and you wouldn't have to worry about them, one of their top leaders is a man called Kurt Stand. He's now serving a 17-year jail sentence in your country for spying for East Germany and the former Soviet Union. From his jail cell in 2008, he wrote a wonderful little article all about the candidate Obama and how he'd been watching him for years and what a transformational president he would make. But speaking of Democratic Socialists of America, the Obama campaign released a video just a few weeks ago, and the premise of it was they wanted to embarrass Mitt Romney, because they said, well, did you know that the man who designed Romney Care in Massachusetts was a man called John McDonough, who was then a Massachusetts state rep? It's not quite true, because McDonough did design it, but Mitt Romney modified it and tried to get it changed extensively. Then they go on to say, well, did you know that we brought in John McDonough and he designed Obamacare too? So ha ha, Mitt Romney. But what they don't say is that John McDonough was for many years the Boston chair of Democratic Socialists of America. So a Marxist basically had a hand in designing both systems. And this happens all the time, folks. The mechanism is simple. The key is the labor unions. And since 1995, when John Sweeney became president of the AFL-CIO, your country's main labor union body, he's a member of Democratic Socialists of America. He took out that organization's anti-communist clause from its constitution, and the Marxists have flooded back. The Marxists now control every major labor union in this country, from the AFL-CIO, SEIU, AFSCME, NEA, you name it, they run it. So how it works is simple. Small Communist Party, the Communist Party, or Democratic Socialists of America, or both of them working together, formulate a policy. This is what we want for America. Then they go to the labor unions and they make it labor union policy. Card check, cap and trade, comprehensive immigration reform, whatever it is. So it becomes labor union policy. The labor unions go to Democrat Party conventions at state or national level and put that policy forward as their policy. And because they're the biggest block of voters, they get it adopted as Democrat Party policy. They also get Democrats elected, and there's hardly a Democrat in this country from state to national level who does not owe his job to the labor unions. So they basically dictate policy to them. You want our support, you do what we tell you. You promote this legislation. You vote that way. So that's how the communists, by using the labor unions, can dictate Democrat Party policy. And they do it all the time. If you want to know what the Democrats are going to do tomorrow, you read the Communist Party USA's People's World or Democratic Socialists of America's Democratic Left, because what's in their pages today will be Democratic Party policy tomorrow. And that's how they do it. You guys think the Democrats done it. It wasn't the Democrats, it was the communists using the labor unions to make the Democrats do what they want. So, Mr. Obama, a lot of people say to me, Barack Obama made a great movement. Look what he achieved. I say the opposite. I say a movement made Mr. Obama. And that movement started in Hyde Park, Chicago, in the early 1950s. And is there anybody here from Chicago who dares to admit it? No one. Okay? It's a beautiful city, but we all know the politics sucks there, don't we? Okay, now, South Chicago is a pretty bleak area. You know, it's industrial, it's pretty poverty-stricken. But there's a little oasis called Hyde Park. And that's the area around the University of Chicago. Very affluent, leafy, green, and full of socialists. Back in the 1950s, the Daily Democrats ran Chicago. Very corrupt, they ran the place. But the communists and socialists of Hyde Park, working through the Democrats, decided to take the dailies on. They wanted to take them out. So this was basically communist Democrats versus gangster Democrats. So they knew to do that, they were going to have to broaden their base. So the communists and socialists and Democrats of Hyde Park formed a big alliance with the blacks and the Latinos and the labor unions of South Chicago. So communists, socialists, Democrats, blacks, labor unions, and Latinos. Does that sound familiar at all? That is the blueprint for the Obama machine. That's where it started. The first person they elected was a man called Leon Dupre to the Chicago City Council. He was a lawyer and a big thorn in the side to the dailies. But when he left the council, he became a very close friend and a mentor to a young lawyer called Mr. Obama, Barack Obama. But back in the 1920s, Leon Dupre was going down to the local rifle range in Chicago with his best friend, Saul Alinsky, to practice target shooting, rifle shooting for the communist revolution they believed was just around the corner. In the 1940s, Leon Dupre was going down to Mexico City to visit with Leon Trotsky, the exiled Soviet leader then hiding out from Comrade Stalin. The next person they elected was in 1983. They got a man, a black lawyer named Harold Washington, elected as mayor of Chicago. Washington was a long-time Communist Party supporter, and he stacked his administration from top to bottom with Marxists. Absolutely stacked it. The next person they elected, they'll usually get a few eyes rolling at this one, was a woman called Carol Moseley Brown to the U.S. Senate from Illinois in 1992. Very corrupt individual, a long-time Communist Party supporter, almost certainly a secret Communist Party member. She only lasted one term, and then President Clinton made her an ambassador from your country overseas. And guess where he sent her? Worse than Russia, he sent her to New Zealand. So we got a corrupt Chicago communist sympathizer as our representative from your country. Thank you, Mr. Clinton. Great honor. The next person they elected was in 1996. They got Mr. Obama elected to the Illinois State Senate, though there is a little bit of a story to that one. Then, by using their networks, then they got him elected to the U.S. Senate in 2004. Then by using their networks nationwide, they put him into the White House in 2008. And Mr. Obama knows exactly who put him into power, and he's been fulfilling their agenda every day of his term of office, doing what they want. So why would Mr. Obama be so keen to work with the radical left, the old communists that we thought had all curled up and gone away to die? Well, really, that's all he has ever done. He's a red diaper baby, brought up in the movement. He has only ever worked with Marxists and socialists. Right from the word go. Now, the very first significant mentor to Mr. Obama, who's heard of a man called Frank Marshall Davis? Quite a few of you, okay. Frank Marshall Davis started out, really got famous in the 1940s in Chicago. He was a writer, a jazz critic, a poet, a journalist. And that was the time of the black left, the jazz era. It was cool to be a communist in Chicago at that time, especially if you were black. And Frank Marshall Davis was a communist, a member of the Dorie Miller Club of the Chicago Communist Party. And he was a big part of the movement there. He was lionized. He was a hero of the movement. But in 1948, he left all of the glamour and glitz behind and moved out to a little backwater in the Pacific, Hawaii. And at that time, it was a backwater before statehood, before the tourist trade. So why would he have done that? Well, a few years before that, Comrade Stalin had ordered his minions in the United States Communist Party to put as many comrades as they could out onto the islands. And what do you think interested Comrade Stalin in Hawaii? The same thing that interested the Japanese in 1941, Pearl Harbor. Because as I've said, your military and your military alliances was then and is today Moscow's number one target. And Comrade Stalin wanted as many spies as he could get in Hawaii to monitor Pearl Harbor and as many agitators as he could get to get the bases closed down. At one stage, they even had a plan to stage a communist revolution in Hawaii to hand the bases over to Stalin. That was a little bit impractical, but they were still interested in Pearl Harbor. Now, Frank was a loyal communist out in Hawaii. Well, I'll tell you, there's another thing that interested them too, because they were anticipating Hawaiian statehood, because they knew that if they could take over the local Democrat Party, which they did, that would mean that they could gain control of Hawaii's presidential electoral college votes, which could be very important in a tight presidential race. It also meant that they could get two more left-wing senators and a whole bunch of left-wing congressmen in your government forever, which they have achieved. That is exactly why the communists started and ran the Washington, D.C. statehood movement and are very interested in the Puerto Rican statehood movement. It's nothing to do with the rights of Puerto Ricans or Washingtonians. It's all about getting control of those presidential electoral college votes and getting more left-wing senators and congressmen into your government. That's what it's all about. So Frank was a good communist in Hawaii. He infiltrated the Democrat Party, held office in it. But he was also working for a labor union publication out there, the Honolulu Record. And his boss was a man called Koji Ariyoshi, Japanese-American communist who had worked with the United States Army in China during World War II with Mao Tse-tung's communists against the Japanese. After World War II, Ariyoshi went to New York where he worked with the AmerAsia people. AmerAsia was a left-wing magazine staffed by communists and several known Soviet KGB agents who were working with the secret communists inside your State Department to tilt US foreign policy away from Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist Chinese armies towards Mao Tse-tung's communist Chinese. And because they succeeded in getting your government to withdraw military support for Chiang Kai-shek, 500 million Chinese were delivered to the communists. A small group of American traitors changed world history. And we're still feeling the effects of that today. So Frank Marshall Davis, the man that most liberals describe as a civil rights campaigner, basically was under FBI surveillance for 19 years, the subject of a 600-page FBI file. And the FBI were very worried about Frank because they were getting reports on a regular basis that he was seen photographing Hawaiian beaches with a camera with telescopic lenses. And I think they suspected military espionage on behalf of the Soviet Union because they put Frank Marshall Davis on the security index. That was reserved for the most dangerous communists only and meant that if war had ever broken out with the Soviet Union, Mr. Davis could have been arrested that very day. Now, about 1970, a young man, Barry Satoru, moved from Indonesia back to Hawaii to get an education. And his maternal grandfather, Stanley Dunham, decided the young boy needed a black mentor, a black father figure to guide him through the teenage years. So he picked out his friend, his dope-smoking and whiskey-drinking buddy, Frank Marshall Davis, to do the job. And Mr. Obama mentions a guy called Frank 22 times in his book, Dreams from My Father, as a mentor, a guide, someone he turned to for advice, someone he discussed politics with, as a father figure. But only ever mentions him as Frank. And that's pretty surprising, considering how open and transparent your president tends to be. Why do you think he didn't want it known that his mentor was a card-carrying member of the Communist Party USA on the FBI's security index? And some people have said to me, they say, oh, look, you know, by that time, Frank was just a dope-smoking old alcoholic, you know, nothing to see here, don't worry about that. But as late as 1979, Frank Marshall Davis was still listed as an endorser of the American Committee for the Protection of Foreign Born, the Communist Party's main front of the time. And two names below Frank Marshall Davis was listed another activist, a man called Hugh DeLacy. Hugh DeLacy. And I'd like you to remember that name for later in the talk. So Obama leaves Hawaii as about a 19-year-old, goes to Occidental College, mixes with the Democratic Socialist Alliance people there, Tom Hayden's radicals, goes to Columbia, works with the Democratic Socialists of America people there, goes out to Chicago, inspired, as he says, by the election of the black mayor, the Marxist Harold Washington. Then he goes to Harvard to get a law degree. There, both he and Michelle were mentored by a Marxist professor, pro-Cuban activist, Cuba traveler, a man called Charles Ogletree. Then he comes back to Chicago, and his eyes are set on a political career. And the woman who got Mr. Obama his first job in politics and mentored him for several years was a black Illinois state senator named Alice Palmer. Now, the two worked together for several years. They were both involved with the New Party, which was a radical Marxist group that was set up by Democratic Socialists of America, SEIU, and ACORN to infiltrate the Democrat Party. When I exposed that in 2008, and Obama's membership of that party, the Obama campaign flatly denied it, flatly denied he'd ever been a member, despite numerous references to that fact in their own publications. Obama wasn't just a member, he set it up, he started it. He was one of the main initiators of it. But anyway, Alice Palmer decided to run for Congress. And the deal was, she employed Obama as her chief of staff. And she said to him, Barack, you get me elected to Congress and you can take my state Senate seat. And it was Alice Palmer that took Barack Obama to the famous meeting in Hyde Park in the drawing room of Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, famous Weather Underground terrorist leaders from the 1960s. Quentin Young, the doctor, was there at the same meeting. That was Obama's introduction to the Hyde Park left. But things don't always go smoothly in politics, and Alice Palmer lost the primary. So she turned to Mr. Obama and said, look, sorry, Barry, you're going to have to step down. I need my state Senate seat back. And Obama says, tough, Alice, I'm running. And he got her disqualified off the ballot by challenging her signatures, many of which were fraudulent. Fancy that, eh? Even in Chicago. And he got all the other opponents disqualified in the same manner. So he won the election unopposed. But that caused a big ruction on the Chicago left. And a local communist named Timuel Black, who was a friend of both Obama and Alice Palmer's, was brought in to mediate. But even he couldn't sort it out, and the two went their separate ways. But it's fair to say that Alice Palmer was a significant mentor to Mr. Obama and the woman who got him his first job in politics. But she had a little bit of a history. In 1980, she was invited to Grenada, an island in the Caribbean, to the first anniversary celebrations of that country's Marxist-Leninist revolution by its communist dictator, Morris Bishop. and the invitation cards are in my book. In 1983, Bishop was murdered by some of his own comrades, and in the ensuing chaos, President Reagan sent troops onto the island to sort it out. And my friend was training at Moscow at Lenin's Institute when that happened, and the Soviets were absolutely spewing. They were spitting tacks that bloody Ronald Reagan had shut down what was going to become the second Cuba of the Caribbean. So we got Mr. Reagan to thank for that one. The same year, Alice Palmer was in Prague in communist Czechoslovakia for a meeting of the World Peace Council. Now that is very significant because the World Peace Council was then, and it still exists today, the Soviet Union's number one international front. They put billions of rubles into that organization. It had affiliates in almost every country of the world. And its job was to propagandize against your military, against your military alliances, against your weapon systems, against anything that would keep your country safe and keep your allies safe. The Soviet Union's number one front. And incidentally, when my friend was training in Moscow, he sat down one day and talked to Comrade Venediv, one of the tutors from the Institute, and they were talking about the New Zealand political situation and how they were going to scam New Zealand through the peace movement. And Comrade Venediv said, John, he said, there are many very clever people in the Soviet Union, but no one has ever come up with a weapon as powerful as the peace movement. That is the store the Soviets put in peace propaganda, anti-US military propaganda. Alice Palmer was also running the Black Press Institute out of Chicago, a nationwide network of black communist journalists. And their job was to sow Soviet propaganda amongst your country's black population. Some of these guys were also connected to the Palestine Liberation Organization, which was incidentally set up by the Soviet Union to attack Israel. In 1985, Alice Palmer took 16 of these black communists to East Germany, Czechoslovakia and the Soviet Union for meetings with high-ranking government officials and the editor of Pravda. In 1986, Alice Palmer was in Moscow covering that year's annual conference of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. The same year, she was elected North American Vice President of the International Organization of Journalists, a bona fide Soviet international front. So Alice Palmer, to put it bluntly, the woman who gave your president his first job in politics, was a high-level Soviet agent of influence, connected to at least three Soviet bloc governments at the highest levels and two major Soviet international fronts. Her job with the International Organization of Journalists was to monitor activities for the Soviet Union in Canada, the United States, Mexico and the Caribbean. And her job was to implement what they called their new information order, which was all to do with issues of media fairness. Media fairness. Now who remembers the fairness doctrine? That was abolished under Reagan. It was the idea that if you owned a radio station and you put a conservative on for 2 hours in the afternoon, you had to give 2 hours to a liberal. Equal time. Social justice of the airways. Because it wasn't fair that a conservative should attract sponsorship and a listenership when the poor dumb liberal sap would get neither. So they had to even it up. And that made conservative talkback uneconomic. And it was only when Reagan abolished it that you got the Rush Limbaughs and the Sean Hannitys and the Glenn Becks and the education that I'm sure many of you people have benefited from. And you wonder why Mr. Obama would like to reintroduce a fairness doctrine and extend it to the internet through what he calls net neutrality. Could it be that he wants to shut your voices down? Surely not. So Frank Marshall Davis, communist, possible Soviet spy, anti-military activist. Alice Palmer, Democrat, Soviet agent of influence, anti-military activist. Two key people in Mr. Obama's early career. But what about today? What about the people around Obama now? I'm sure nobody wants to be here till 4 o'clock in the morning to deal with the bulk of them, but I would just want to pick on three of them that I consider most important. First is a woman, the other half of Obama's brain, and even the liberals call her that, Valerie Jarrett, introduced Obama to his wife and now sits in the White House as Obama's closest friend and most trusted advisor, easily the most powerful woman in America and possibly the most powerful person. What about her background? What about her pedigree? Well, Valerie Jarrett's mother is a woman in Chicago called Barbara Bowman, child psychologist, runs the Erickson Institute, which has had a lot of influence in early childhood education in your country. In 2009, President Obama gave Barbara Bowman an award for her work, and that ceremony was prominently featured in the pages of the Communist Party USA's People's World. Now, the Erickson Institute, named after a man called Eric Erickson. And are there any old 60s hippies here at all? No, not in Montana. But they do say if you can remember the 60s, you weren't really there. Well, some of you might have heard the phrase identity crisis. He's having an identity crisis, leave him alone. That was Eric Erickson, disciple of Sigmund Freud. But back in the 1940s, Eric Erickson was kicked out of Berkeley in California because he refused to sign an anti-communist loyalty oath. At the same time, he was a lecturer at the California Labor School, the Communist Party's main trade union school. On the board of the Erickson Institute have served Tom Ayers, the father of Weather Underground terrorist Bill Ayers, and Bernadine Dorn, the wife of Bill Ayers and a famous terrorist in her own right. Valerie Jarrett's maternal grandfather, a man called Robert Taylor, first black head of the Chicago Housing Authority. Back in 1940, he was affiliated with an organization called the American Peace Mobilization. And that word peace will come up a lot. The American Peace Mobilization was the Communist Party's main front of the time. And their job was, guess what? Was to keep you guys, your government and your troops out of World War II. Because at the time, Hitler was overrunning Europe and was about to conquer Britain. And there was a lot of pressure in this country to come to Britain's aid. But those communists didn't want that, because at that time, Stalin was still allied to Hitler through the Non-Aggression Pact. And Stalin had told your American communists, keep your troops out of Europe so my friend Hitler can finish the job and conquer Britain. But in 1941, Hitler betrayed Stalin and invaded the Soviet Union. Within 24 hours, the American peace mobilization became the American people's mobilization. The most pro-war, let's get Hitler, let's destroy the Nazis organization in the country. 24 hours, painted out one word, put in the other. That is how deep the communist commitment to peace is. Peace when it suits them, war when it doesn't. And Robert Taylor served in that organization with a man, a fellow comrade called Frank Marshall Davis. The other side of Valerie Jarrett's family, her late father-in-law, Vernon Jarrett, a black guy, a journalist, very prominent in Chicago. The last thing he did when he was dying of cancer in 2004 was to issue a call to the black population of Chicago to get out and vote for Barack Obama in that year's Senate primaries. But go back to 1946. Vernon Jarrett was serving on the Illinois state executive of a wonderful sounding organization, American Youth for Democracy. Wouldn't you all love your kids to belong to that? Said there was a youth wing of the Communist Party USA. 1948, Vernon Jarrett was serving on the Packing House Workers Strike Committee Publicity Committee. The Packing House Workers were a communist labor union out on strike, and Vernon Jarrett was writing their press releases and propaganda. And on that tiny little publicity committee with Vernon Jarrett served a man called Frank Marshall Davis. Now, isn't it interesting that the two most powerful people in your country, Barack Obama and Valerie Jarrett, can both trace their political lineage back to the Chicago Communist Party of the 1940s and specifically to Frank Marshall Davis of security of the FBI's Security Index? Wouldn't read about it, would you? I'll go for one more guy, then we'll have a break, and then I'll get into the important part of the talk. Okay? The other half of Obama's brain, which doesn't leave very much. Okay? Joe Biden, perhaps? David Axelrod. Okay? David Axelrod, the man who wins elections with negative campaigning and blackening the name of his opponents. And you can all see that in the current campaign, in the DNC a few weeks ago. Back in 2004, when Mr. Obama was running for the US Senate against Jack Ryan, a Republican who was very much favoured to win, some secret divorce records were illegally unsealed, a sex scandal was uncovered, and Jack Ryan was sunk. And Obama, of course, won. But where did Mr. Axelrod learn his trade? Learn his tricks. Well, when he came to Hyde Park, Chicago in the 1970s to study political science, he was picked up and mentored by two very prominent local journalists and activists, Don Rose and David S. Cantor. Now, these guys worked together with Axelrod as a team on the Carol Moseley Brown election campaigns, on the second Harold Washington campaign. And Don Rose basically got Axelrod his first job in big-time journalism. They worked with him for several years, mentored him. But before they'd done that, they had another project. They ran a publication in Hyde Park, Chicago, the Hyde Park Kenwood Voices. And it was the voice of the Hyde Park left. It carried articles about Quentin Young's trip to North Vietnam during the war to give aid to the communists, about his son Ethan's trip to Cuba to cut sugarcane for Castro. They had a regular column by a local congressman named Abner Mikva. He was very much part of their operation. Mikva was a big opponent of your Second Amendment in Congress, hated gun rights. When he left Congress, he became an open supporter in Chicago of Democratic Socialists of America and a law professor at the University of Chicago. And when he was a law professor there, he befriended and mentored for several years a young fellow colleague, Barack Obama. He also mentored for many years another American lawyer who I'm sure you're all very familiar with, and that is Elena Kagan, who now serves on your Supreme Court. But Don Rose, one half of the partnership, longtime communist fronter, coined the phrase in 1968, "The whole world is watching." And that was during the big SDS riots in Chicago that year, which Don Rose helped to organise. He was an executive member with Timuel Black and Quentin Young of a wonderful sounding Chicago organisation, the Chicago Committee to Defend the Bill of Rights. Now, wouldn't you all back that one? Except it was the Communist Party's main front in Chicago. The other half of the partnership, David Cantor. His father was Harry Cantor, leader of the Massachusetts Communist Party in the 1930s. 1932, he took his whole family, including baby David, to the Soviet Union, where they lived for several years. Harry Cantor was granted a personal audience with Comrade Stalin. He was given a job translating Lenin's works from Russian into English, which to a communist is the equivalent of being allowed to translate the Bible. By the 1940s, both Harry and David Cantor were living in Chicago, back in the States, both active members of the Communist Party. In 1948, Harry Cantor bought a little communist publication, the Chicago Star, off its owner. And why do you think the owner wanted to sell it? Well, he's moving to Hawaii, wasn't he? It was Frank Marshall Davis. Go forward to 1960. David Cantor and his best friend, Leroy Wolins, another communist, who incidentally founded Veterans for Peace, yet another Communist Party anti-military front, run a little publishing company out of Chicago, Translation World Publishers. And they were getting a regular subsidy from the Soviet embassy in Washington to distribute Russian and communist literature all over your country. The two men were actually required by your government to formally register as agents of the Soviet Union. Go forward to 1964. Any Goldwater girls here or Goldwater guys? One or two? That was a big race. Barry Goldwater, the Republican, Lyndon Johnson, the Democrat. Johnson won. You got the Great Society, the biggest expansion of welfare and federal power since the New Deal. And you're still feeling the impacts of that today. The other guy, Barry Goldwater, was a conservative, a constitutionalist, a patriot. He would have loved the Tea Party, and the Tea Party would have loved him. Had he won that election, this country would be a lot stronger today. But he didn't win. The Kennedy assassination sealed the deal. But Barry Goldwater was vilified in the press in this country as a racist, a fascist, and an extremist. Anybody from the Tea Party here might find some of those words familiar. Heard them in recent times. It's no accident. One of the main sources of the vilification of Barry Goldwater was Translation World Publishers out of Chicago, David Cantor's little firm. So your Mr. Axelrod got his training for several years at the hands of a Soviet-paid professional black propagandist and character assassin. That is what you're up against with Mr. Axelrod. So I'll give you guys a break. The important stuff is to come.